Welcome, everybody, to the Troubadour Podcast. My name is Kirk, and today I have on the show Joe Diamond. Joe Diamond is now officially the assistant editor for Troubadour Magazine. He's also published The Gentleman Thief, and he's putting on his first course, and he's going to kind of help launch the courses that we do here and in the future with Troubadour Magazine, and it's called Sci-Fi Lit and Writing. It's a sci-fi lit and writing course. So we wanted to talk about, that's actually what we're going to focus our time today is not just the course, but the actual literature that's included in it. This is technically a writing course, but it's also a literature. You're going to get to, read some great literature. The three short stories are going to be Rappaccini's Daughter by Nathaniel Hawthorne, Harrison Bergeron by Kurt Vonnegut, and a Song Before Sunset by David Griggs. Now, Joe, why don't you tell us quickly a little bit about yourself and why you're excited about these three stories?
All right. Well, I live out here in Maui, Hawaii, originally from Northern California. I got my philosophy bachelor's at Chico State, but also attended UC Santa Cruz. let's see. I'm currently in an MFA program. It's an online program from Lindenwood University in Missouri. So I work out here doing, property management, odd jobs, and take this on the side, raising my son up. And I found Kirk's magazine because I was looking for publication in a magazine that might be, accepting of more objectivist style writing. And I inquired with the ARIs, one of their outreach people, and they led me to Kirk. And he helped me get my thing polished where I was thinking, okay, this is actually a good piece of writing, not just me trying to get something published, to put on my CV, to get a job, to live my life like that. Now it's a good piece of writing. I got people in my program that are like reading it, and they're like, wow, this is good. And so it's cool. I feel like I have something polished, and I also feel like it's somewhere that is, it's somewhere cool. Like I don't need to go and try to get it in the New Yorker. Like it's in Troubadour Magazine. We're building something cool here. I was stoked to be made assistant editor. So it's good. It's like, I feel like I've done something and it's given me confidence to move on to my other pieces. We got a couple more in the works. I also did a poem for Christmas, about, the commercialization of, the positive commercialization of the holiday. And yep. So I've been working with Kirk to find the right science fiction short stories for this course that we're developing. And this is also to for me to try my hand at teaching. I've done some private music teaching in the charter school setting, and I've done private guitar lessons, music theory lessons in the past. I played a lot of music. I'm an objectivist. I've had colleges, Santa Cruz, I had an objectivist Ayn Rand club, and then at Chico State, I had one. Always small clubs, but I've been active in that, and always, rereading Ayn Rand and stuff. So my literature love is, Ayn Rand, just discovering Hugo now, but I've read a lot of popular fiction, Lee Child, James Rollins, Harry Potter, So, yeah, it's fun to do these short stories because I had never read Hawthorne. Now I can say I've read Hawthorne. I have a feel for him. That's what I'm really liking about these short stories. And I think that the literary journal has value in that way for people. And there's a lot of literary journal stuff out there that's just boring. Nobody wants to be part of it, including myself. But it's actually a cool medium. And I think that we're trying at Troubadour now to get it out there to people that enjoy art, generally they're listening to the radio, they're going to see movies, they're buying novels. Here's a short story. It's not just a dorky thing that MFAs are dealing with. It's a real thing. It's enjoyable. It's fun. It's cool. And it'll make you more charming and attractive as a person if you read a lot of short stories.
That's right. So let's talk about Rappaccini's Daughter, Harrison Bergeron, and A Song Before Sunset. Now, We talked about a variety of different short stories that we could include in this course that you're putting on. And it's a short workshop. It's four sessions, 60-minute sessions live. So you get to interact with Joe. I'll probably be there as well, but this is going to be Joe's course, his, he's lecturing and talking. And then there's feed, you're writing stuff and getting feedback as well on your writing. But we talked about different short stories that we could include in this course. And, you know, we talked about some Bradbury. I think you had some more contemporary stuff. And you know, I think we decided to have kind of a mixture of, you know, like a what would be considered a 19th century classic with Rappaccini's Daughter. And then we have a kind of modern classic. And then with Harrison Bergeron. Kurt Vonnegut, 20th century. Good way of putting it. And then we have a much more modern or contemporary, like, I don't know the exact publication date, much more recent with David Griggs, A Song Before Sunset. Now, we're not going to go into detail on all of these stories, but I thought it might be interesting to talk about like why we selected them, what they're about a little bit, and what's interesting about them, and maybe how they're all kind of maybe even, you know, see where it goes and where our discussion goes, because we don't have any plan. We've just each read these. We like these stories and we thought they were worth reading. Now, A Song Before Sunset. We'll actually start with that because it's, I think, one of the easier ones at a certain degree.
Yeah.
A Song Before Sunset is essentially about, it's a dystopian future where a piano player, right? I read this like a week and a half ago, so I'm trying to remember. Yeah. A piano player,
where he was a piano player, a virtuoso.
He's not, thank you. He's not just a piano player. He's a virtuoso, but he's living in this scarce resource dystopian post-apocalypse.
Yep. Future. It comes from Wastelands, a post-apocalyptic collection.
Yeah.
Feature stories by Stephen King, Octavia E. Butler, Orson Scott Card, George R.R. Martin, Gene Wolfe. It's funny because a lot of these bigger names, I read their stories, didn't like them that much. But then some of the smaller names in the anthology were like good. Like this one, I thought, I was like, this is great. I sent it over to Kirk before we were even planning this course. I was just like, this is a cool, I like it. It kind of had that rope, you know, it's the artist that has their, you know, they see the difference between Beethoven and just hunting rats in a post-apocalyptic future. You know, this is like, there's just a contrast of, you know, society where people are going to piano concerts and listening to these, you know, works of genius. And then now they're hunting rats.
Yeah.
And
that's exactly what happens. Yeah. They're hunting rats. And one thing I want to say about all of this and the course and why some of the stuff is important is, I do think that science fiction is one of the more influential literature, genres of today. I mean, not only are they some of the most, popular and successful movies and shows of our time,
Harry Potter.
Yeah, I mean, if you could
put,
I would put those more in fantasy, but even like Matrix and you could say Star Wars to some degree, but if you know, Avatar, if you look at some of the most successful movies of the past 25 years, not all of them, but a big chunk of them are sci-fi or like Star Wars, they're sci-fi-esque. They're in that kind of vein a little bit, right?
Totally.
So it really shapes our mind quite a bit in the science fiction. So this one was really interesting because dystopians, of course, are about a future that is not good. It's a negative future, the opposite of an ideal society. This is the end of society.
As opposed to utopian.
As opposed to utopian. And this character, Parnell?
Correct, I think.
Is you know, living in this world. He's trying to get if I remember correctly, he's trying to get a sledgehammer.
Yep, he's 65 looking for a sledgehammer.
Yeah, 65 looking for a sledgehammer. Which
no,
is really...
I'm sorry. He found a sledgehammer.
Yes.
And the sledgehammer is a cool thing to have, you know.
Because he's going to trade it. So, you know, it's this whole thing where it's like, why is this guy trained? And we learn about him that he's, a concert pianist, or he was, and he's trying to basically find out. I don't want to give away the whole ending. I want you guys to read it. But we find out that he has found a piano and he wants to kind of play
a tuned piano. He has a piano that can hardly be tuned, a student kind of piano,
but he finds a real concert
shack.
He finds
a concert hall with a piano under the dust cover,
and he's got to tune it himself, and
so he finds his concert hall
and then
finally.
In the background, and this is the last thing I'll say about this, there are these, you know, hordes of something burning
vandals.
Buildings. We'll just leave it at that. And then, so that's kind of the premise. And we'll just, you know, I don't want to get, like I said, I think the ending is worth consideration and thinking about. I'll say for those who are interested, I was not a fan of the ending, but some people
ending
might...
was a thinker. The ending was a thinker for me. I wasn't.
You do have to think about it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a thinker. It's kind of, yeah. You know, it's interesting.
Maybe we have to tell the ending, actually.
No spoilers. I don't like spoilers. I like this story too much to have a spoiler.
Yeah, it's hard to talk about stories without spoiling them, though.
Let's go over all three.
And see what happens.
Maybe we could do a spoiler.
Maybe we could skip it to, yeah.
I want them to take the course if they see this, if they're interested.
Yeah, that's, well, so this is a writing course, though.
I hate spoilers.
I don't, but
I'm with. You know, I hate them. Well, I can't even watch a trailer. My wife watches trailers for movies. I can't watch the end of a trailer. Oh,
trailers are like,
show the whole movie.
Better than most movies, though.
I know, I like making the trailer, but by the time I've seen the trailer, I've seen the movie. It's like, oh, okay, that's.
But that's not the fault of the trailer. It's the fault of the movie.
I know.
Why? Like, so a lot of times I just watch the trailer. I don't even watch the movie because the trailer is so good. I don't need to watch it.
Yeah, once I see it,
they're so good.
I'm a suspense, like,
I cry harder in trailers than in good movies or movies these days. But yeah, so let's do it this way. We'll talk maybe about the, at the end, if there's time, if we need to.
Yeah.
That spoilers. That way people don't have to skip them. You know, if you want to, we'll let you know when we're going to talk about the conclusions to these stories.
Yeah, this will be our overview here.
That's The Song of Sunset. It's an interesting dystopian.
Song Before Sunset by David Griggs.
Yeah, it's an interesting dystopian novel. And about a
short story.
And one thing I like about it is the value pursuit that he is trying to do the thing that he loves. And that's what's sustaining him. And I'll just say, yeah. I think that's an important thing, is he's not living for the sake of living.
No, he's not trying to get the next biggest rat.
Exactly.
He found a sledgehammer, so now he can get the big rat and he can sit there and all, you know, this isn't about that. This is about, yeah.
About music and the purpose of useless things. And that, you know, and I think it's
of art, you know,
I think it's kind of an argument for that. And, you know, maybe the ending can win me over at some point. But we'll leave that aside. Okay, the next story is Harrison Bergeron.
Yep, working our way back in the centuries here.
Now we're working backwards. Now, Harrison Bergeron by Kurt Vonnegut. Now, Kurt Vonnegut is a weird writer. Very weird guy. you know, he wrote A Cat's Cradle. You know, he likes to write stories like with midgets and weird weird people, and it's... He's doing this, like, and it's very, what's nice about him, I think, and good, is he's very, what I call, stylized. Like, it's not reality. Yeah. There is a slant to it. It's a, you know, like, it's one of those things, you know, when you're reading a Kurt Vonnegut story, you know, you're in a Victor Hugo world.
Yeah.
Like, if you gave me a Hawthorne story without, you know, the name of the author, just gave it to me in a blank, I'd figure it out pretty quickly that this is Hawthorne, this is Poe. There are certain writers that just have a slant really clearly. Yeah. Kurt Vonnegut's one of them.
Yeah, I haven't discovered his full slant that way, but I did notice this one was like, I love right away the first sentence there. I think, you know, everybody had finally become equal, you know, in every way. Just like put it right out there, you know what I mean? Like, don't, you know, it's setting the stage right there. And I love how just this thing is very succinct in that way. It's just like, it's a really short story. I loved it when I read it. But then, you know, I'll say I read it. It's, I think, published in the 60s and Atlas Shrugged was published, right? Like 57. So I'm kind of thinking, this guy rip off Atlas Shrugged?
No, Anthem.
That was what I
he probably
when
ripped
I read
off
it.
Anthem.
Well, I don't want to get into the spoiler, but the ending of it seemed kind of Harrison Bergeron at the end reminded me a lot of John Galt. You know, this is John Galt speaking. And I was just like, whoa, this is like, John Galt already did this in a lot of ways, you know, but I still love
the
story.
Okay. So yeah, I mean, there is that element maybe, and I'm sure he read, you know, Rand. I mean, she was a massive hit at that point. So I don't know the influence. I'm sure a literary PhD who's really dug into these, like Shoshana Milgram, she might know. So I recommend checking out her courses, by the way. But so what the influence is, I don't know, but the premise of this story, the story Harrison Bergeron is about a world, another dystopian future in the vein of, you know, kind of George Orwell, also Anthem by Ayn Rand, Brave New World. But we get this world where we finally have figured out ways to make everyone equal.
Yeah. And it's what, I love it.
Yeah. That's what we say. And I think a lot of people who have been against egalitarianism, right? And I've been against egalitarianism because it's a ludicrous philosophy.
It's ludicrous. Yeah. And that's so prevalent right now too.
It's just very
like,
prevalent.
I really see it lately. It's like, it's really just everywhere, everything equal. And I'm really seeing, it's like, you know, in my past, it was really a big thing about altruism, like sacrifice your own interest now. But now it's just like this equality thing in everything. It's like, are they going to hunt down all the tall people next? Like, that's going to be the next thing. Like, anybody over 6 foot, it's like, you have 6 foot privilege, you know, 6 footer privilege, you know, like you need to come out and wear your badge of shame right now. 6 footer privilege, you know? So it's just like, that's, I see that everywhere now. Egalitarianism, I feel like, is the core essence of what's going on right in the world right now.
Well, I mean, you see it in every field of business. If you're really good, they need to hamstring you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
They don't do it in sports. Yeah. And when you make the sports analogy, people say, well, why would you do that? Well, it's just like, why would you, you know, break LeBron James's kneecaps so that other people can be as good as he is, right? Like a normal person. And
well,
it's like,
in sports, it's outright. It's like, heavyweight boxers they knock out a light, you know what I mean? Or whatever. It's like, it's obvious there but then they have the heavyweight division, you know?
Well, not even heavyweight division. I just mean like putting like a pro boxer today or an MMA fighter with like me, who's like done it a little bit. I'm going to be murdered, right? Like it's going to be brutal. And so the point is that in the world that a lot of people talk about that they want is they want this equal world where we're all equal. But the point is that in nature, we're not all equal. What we need to be equal from is, of course, equal under the law. We've achieved that. Let's be clear. We've achieved that. But now what people want and what they've wanted for, we've achieved that, I think, for a long time, is they want equality like amongst each other. Like they want to distribute beauty. It's like, okay, give me some of your hair, man. I want some extra hair. You know, I want equality with hair. So either shave, but you can't, like you can't give me your hair. You know, you know, you do a wig, but it's not the same thing. So if we want egalitarianism, really everybody has to shave their head.
That'll be our next story. Like I give Kirk more of my hair and he gives me more of his like clarity and staying on track and thinking like he has tangents more and I have to like shave the front half of my head.
Well, no, but for us to be equal, like, I see what you're saying, but for us to be equal or for to live in a world, and that's what Harrison Bergeron is happening is like, you know, the beautiful people have to wear like weird caps on their teeth, you know, put things in their nose. Like the best ballerina on TV, she has to wear these big heavy chains.
Yeah, that's great. I love the chains. Like, oh, Harrison was like, he was really beautiful and strong. They could hardly get enough chains to weigh the guy down.
He was like 6'10" or something, or 6'9".
Physical Bezos. Like, no matter what they try to do, the guy is just like 10 times better than the best.
Yep. He's just too
much. Wow.
And like, they have this thing that to me is the most horrifying thing. And it almost makes me think of social media. Is this the thing that the father has in his ear that buzzes or does like different sounds to stop him from thinking? And it's like, you know, he'll start thinking about, oh, I remember that. Who is that kid? And then it'll be like cars crashing super loud in his head. That's what he hears. And it's like, and then he forgets what he was thinking about and he can't focus. And so basically it stops people from focusing.
Yeah. They have like a mechanized version of postmodernism, right?
Exactly. Well, it makes me think of social media because like I, especially since a lot of the work I do, I've talked about this on the show, a lot of the work I do is on social media. So it's been like one of the biggest challenges for me is focusing because it's so easy to get distracted.
Yeah.
And so it actually affects my ability to read even when I'm not on social media.
Totally. I deleted my Instagram recently just because it's like I have a toddler, I have writing to do, I don't need to be posting pictures of me working out, looking at Black Lives Matter. This is just like, this is a waste of time. Like, can't do it right now, you know?
No, totally. I get it. So that's Harrison Bergeron, and it's a, you know, I think it's a good story, very short. And it shows you what you could do in like with the short medium.
Totally. It's almost like flash fiction. I don't know if that's you consider that a legitimate even.
Well, I don't know what it means to be legitimate or illegitimate. It's flat. You know, I don't know what you can achieve with flash fiction, but it's interesting. I mean, it's just like.
It's just big thing nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, like
in my world, they flash fiction, short story, novella, novel. That's their for, yeah.
I mean,
whatever.
From an artistic standpoint, it's very limited what you could do. I think short stories that take about an hour to read are amazing. Like that is a good, and the novels, which are much longer, they are the pinnacle in the literary world. Although the most difficult to achieve. But these are still worthwhile. This is probably, 1,500, 2,000 words, I imagine.
I haven't
done a count of it, so very short. And it's really good to see what can be done because you have characters, you understand those characters, like the super beautiful woman who's made to be ugly, the super good-looking, strong son who's made to be, ugly, dumb, and weak, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. And the husband and wife who's watching this on TV.
Yeah.
I think it's an interesting story, and it's something that in the course you guys can not just look at the literature aspect of it, how do you analyze it from character setting? That's all good, but also like achieving what Kurt Vonnegut achieved in a very short space.
Totally. It's a good one. It's a good one. I was happy. It made me happy with my education that I was assigned that story, and also happy with my education that I was assigned Rappaccini's Daughter and Grieg. So, we talk a lot about the soft sciences within mainstream education and how it's weak and whatnot. But occasionally you come up with some good stuff, and it's like, that's why I'm kind of excited about teaching English, because, it leaves you a lot of room for teaching critical thought and for exposing different viewpoints, different sides of the story, So yeah. I'm excited. I think there's hope, So.
So in these two stories, we have a dystopian society in Harrison Bergeron, and in A Song Before Sunset, we have a futuristic, like post-apocalyptic dystopia. Yeah. So those societies are going to look very different. One is you're going after rats and you don't have television or even pianos, and there's nothing like that. There's no structures to society. It's chaos. It's Mad Max. It's anarchy. In Harrison Bergeron, there is a society, but the society is authoritarian. It's blocking your mind. It's got all these rules, and there's, things that happen, and there's a leader with a shotgun, right? Who bursts in, and we won't say what happens, but there's stuff like that where there's a leader that happens. Now, by the way, it's not to say that good things happen in A Song Before Sunset. It's still a bad world, and both of them are dystopias. Now let's go backwards 100 years.
Yeah.
To Rappaccini's Daughter. Now, Rappaccini's Daughter is a story that I love by Nathaniel Hawthorne. I think that Nathaniel Hawthorne has three primary sci-fi stories. They're kind of not sci-fi in the way we think of them. They're more sci-fi in the early 19th century, where this is the beginning of science fiction.
Yeah.
Right. This is, Frankenstein is considered, one of the first science fictions. Mm-hmm. This is written shortly after, some years after that in the 19th century. I think Frankenstein, is 1819, I believe, when it's written.
I'm not sure. This is 1844.
And this is 44. So this is a little bit after. Pretty sure Frankenstein's 1819. And by Mary Shelley, who was only 19 at the time. Anyway,
wow, it's impressive. Yeah,
that's impressive. So this story is not quite it's not really a dystopian, right? It's not about a society. It's not about a society that's oppressive.
Oh, 1818. Sorry for Frankenstein. I knew it would be the introduction to this book.
It's not that, right? It's not dystopian. It's not post-apocalyptic.
Nope.
It's rather a story about a scientist.
Yeah. More mad scientist.
Mad scientist.
More like a mad scientist genre.
Mad scientist who is trying to create a world, maybe even, he's trying to create a utopia, a perfect world, where his daughter is as deadly as she is beautiful.
Correct.
With poisons. And he uses this garden. And he crafted this garden. He raised his daughter, and this garden is poisonous. Yep. And in this poisonous, he raises his daughter to be acclimated to them. And in the process of becoming acclimated to this poisonous garden, she herself becomes poisonous. And her name is Beatrice or Beatrice, depending on how you want to be, you know, extra cultured.
So this takes place in Padua, right? Is that somewhere in the Mediterranean? I didn't get a chance to look up where it is. That is Italy, like Northern Italy or something maybe. Okay. This one was good. It kind of felt like in some ways, you know, symbolic. Like I'm trying to digest what the symbolism in it is or if there is any. And then it also kind of just felt maybe like
if there is any, it's Hawthorne. There's definitely symbolism.
Okay.
And there's definitely a lot of meaning behind it. Yeah.
Okay. And then also there's just a certain fun thing I probably on some respects of, you know, the mad scientist that makes the plants and the, you know, so the symbolism, I mean, there's a certain, without going into the spoiler, to fall in love with a deadly woman, right, is something that's happening here, right? A plot construct. That has symbolism in it.
Well, let's look at the characters. Hold on.
Yeah.
So let's go into the characters. So, because, you know, we'd have to think about what we mean by symbolism in this context. But what we have is a character, Giovanni Gasconti, and he's a student. And he arrives in the, Padua. He kind of longs for his home so he arrives there in Padua to go to school there, and he longs for his home, I think, I don't remember exactly where his home was.
In the south somewhere.
Yeah, he's from the south, I believe.
Because they talk about him being like, you know, in the warm south.
Because he has the passions of the south. That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he's in this University of Padua, and he's in this really ancient, almost not quite a castle, but it feels like a kind of a castle place.
Like a manor or something.
A manor. And it's got this look to it. And he's sad and he looks out this window because of the maid, Dame Lisabetta, and he sees a beautiful garden.
Correct.
And he looks out there, he sees this garden, and he's like, this is amazing.
One moment. I got to switch these.
So this is a story that, you know, you have the Padua character, or you have this character who's in University of Padua. He looks out the window and he sees this beautiful garden and he notices some really weird things about the garden.
Yeah.
Right. He notices, for instance, the assiduous care that it's not like a normal garden. It's like someone, all they do is spend all their time making it the most perfect, angelic, godlike, Edenic garden. And he then notices that there is a young woman in this garden, and she's very beautiful. And he doesn't quite register, but he sees like a lizard that walks up to her, and then the lizard dies. And then at that time, she also gets she's sad about this. That's important. She's sad about this. Giovanni doesn't quite register what happened there. And so he kind of passes on. It just seems like he's looking at this kind of magical forest. And then he sees
starts out, he's looking down, he sees the doctor and the girl and then he sees it kind of evolves into, I think it might be the second meeting or the second viewing of her with the lizard, that after he talks to his sort of mentor or his father's friend, then the lizard dies. But the important thing is that he's kind of wading his way into Beatrice's life, right? He hears about her from the he views her with her father, the doctor, Dr. Rappaccini, and then he talks about them and is warned of them from his father's friend, another professor. Then he views them a little more, and then he discovers the door, and then he tosses her the flowers down there. So, not to get you off track, but
no, that's good. I think
he's working his way into her life. He's viewing her. It's a classic sort of tale of, you know, a beautiful man, you know, discovering a beautiful woman, and then, you know, he sees her, watches her with her family, then brings her the flowers, and then finally they talk, and then they sort of develop this relationship where they're walking around together, but they don't touch at all. And they become very intimate in every way except physically. And that's
yes.
when the plots kind of begins to twist a little bit.
And I think one of the reasons why the story takes on a powerful sci-fi story is because you have this scientist who's trying to create a perfect world and a perfect person. And right. so he's using science as a way to manipulate reality and nature. And he's doing it without thinking about the moral ramifications of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the moral ramifications of making his daughter into this woman who is as beautiful as she is deadly, or as deadly as she is beautiful. Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
And there's a lot of, and part of what makes Hawthorne's story so great is not just the plots. The plots are really simple. Giovanni sees this woman, you know, he falls in love with her at first sight. He goes to university class, can't stop thinking about her. He runs into another, a competitor scientist and I'm blanking on his name at the moment from Rappaccini.
He was, I'll find him. He's right, going to be Dr. Guia. He might be a G too.
Baglioni.
Baglioni, right.
Yeah, Dr. Baglioni. And, you know, Dr. Baglioni starts to say, oh, so it seems like you're infected with love for this woman. It's almost like you're part of some experiment by this doctor, right? Almost like you're part of the experiment. And he kind of hints at that. But Giovanni is so passionate, so full of love, he pursues Beatrice anyway. And he keeps going down and he starts talking to her. They fall in love. And then he finds out, you know, as he goes up, he finds out that when he breathes, all these, like, the spider dies and he has become infected in the way she has. He is then confronted with giving an antidote by Baglioni, gives him an antidote. And, you know, you'll have to find out what happens after that. I'll leave it at that at the moment, since we're not giving away spoilers. But that's the basic plot. And then there's a confrontation, right, of Baglioni, or really it's between Beatrice and Giovanni. And what is really interesting to me is how the inner poisons of, like, passion, for instance, and versus Beatrice's virtue. Like, Beatrice is drawn as very virtuous and good and right acting. And she's a good person and she's being manipulated. It's not her fault. She's been poisoned. It's not, but she has this malady that's been imposed upon her.
Right.
By a man, some people would say by a man, by her father, whatever the case may be. And then because of one, the jealousy of Baglioni, because he's afraid of Rappaccini's power, who's this renowned scientist, and he's afraid that the daughter will be even more powerful in terms of intelligence and that she's going to take over his
position.
That's right, And then you have Giovanni, who's basically full of lust, right? And he just wants to be with her. And that kind of poisons the internal part of it. So does that make sense? I think there's a big, there's an important aspect of the two, inner virtue versus outer deadliness.
Yeah.
And then the switch that happens.
Yeah. You're right on track there.
Anything you got?
We painted the big picture there. So yeah, this is the part that I'm still kind of, like, you know, working through stylistically. And, in terms of, like, the plot devices, I feel comfortable, you know, with this story, but that's the kind of part I wanted to talk with you more about, is the what this means in terms of, like, a greater symbolic or thematic meaning, you know. He's giving us something to think about there, Hawthorne is, you know.
So what's your question?
So I guess it's not so much a question as, what do you think that he's saying about love? Do you think he's trying to say something about love in general? Like, I don't think he's painting a picture that love is, you know, just inherently doomed or, you know, contradictory to our best interests.
So I'm
didn't
not,
get
I'm
that
not,
feeling from it, you know?
I'm not thinking that you're, like, so who... Who loves whom in this story?
I think that Beatrice loves Giovanni.
Okay.
For coming down to her, you know, he's taking the risk of being down there with her. And Giovanni, he thinks that he loves her. And I think that at the end, he realizes that he does love her. Because he, you know, continues to pursue her even against the risk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a conscious thought. He realizes I think makes some mention there that he's aware that he is under the influence of lust or passion.
Okay.
But he still decides that it's worth it, or that he's going to do it.
What's worth it?
That risking his life, or his health at least, is worth.
Well, he says toward the end he has been given no choice now. He's been trapped. Because now part of what happens when you get this disease is you're now isolated from the rest of the world, right?
Right.
Because if he interacts with people, he kills them. Just like if Beatrice interacts with people, she would kill them. The only reason that Giovanni survives is because it was his immunities were built up over time Rappaccini. This is part of the process that Rappaccini was thinking about. So Rappaccini, Dr. Rappaccini, loves his daughter, I think. And he's trying to, as a father, you know, who knows he's going to die, and he's this powerful man, and he has this, you know, innocent virginal daughter, virtuous daughter, who, you know, is susceptible to the horrors of the outside world without his protection. And so he decided to give her a protection, and that protection is to be deadly, right? He tells the story. So there's a story within a story where he tells of Alexander and the Indian, I believe Indian, the Indian prince who gave a gift. I think it was Indian, or maybe Egyptian. I don't remember the exact, colony or people, but and they you know, so it's the story of this woman that he falls in love with, and the woman has been poisoned so that just kissing her will kill Alexander, but he, you know, turns it away, of course. So but the point is that the father loves Beatrice, or at least a certain kind of love, right? A certain kind of protectiveness, and he wants to protect her and make her invincible to the world. And that's basically what he tries to do, or at least powerful in the world, right?
Yeah.
So that's one way. If you take a story where he's, go ahead, read that.
It was an Indian prince. I can read the passage.
No, I don't.
Too long. Yeah.
I think it's a little, unless it's like you have like a sentence or something, but that's the general idea of the story within a story is.
Yep.
There's the Indian prince. Yeah. So, he loves her. Now, if you imagine it. As a mother who wanted to do something, you know, so if you think about the role of father, the role of mother in this case, if it was a mother, the difference, the way that I think it would play out would be that she would try to protect Beatrice by sheltering her completely from the outside world. Whereas Rappaccini wants to make her so powerful, she can kind of dominate the outside world. That's kind of the male masculine viewpoint versus the female. And if you want to kind of get a background mythology to this, I'm blanking on it. You need to read the Grimm's fairy tale, Rapunzel.
Gotcha.
And that's kind of what the story essentially is, but with a female. So that the story of Rapunzel, and Grimm's fairy tale, by the way, actually begins with a husband and a wife who have a beautiful daughter, and there's an evil witch across.
Or Tangled for the layperson by Disney.
No, forget Tangled. I like Tangled, but it's not relevant here. You know, but because we're looking at Grimm's fairy tale, the actual German translated thing. But what you actually start with is a husband and wife who have a daughter, and there is and I don't remember the name of the plant, but there's a beautiful plant that the mother, or the wife, wants. And it's in the land, the territory owned by an old witch. So one day the husband decides to go get it. He goes, he jumps over this fence, goes to get it, and is captured by the witch, essentially. And I'm trying to remember the story as I go. And then basically, and I think the name of the plant is something like Rapunzia or Rapasha. And that's where Rappaccini comes from, by the way.
Okay, wow.
Yeah, something, there's a definite relation in Hawthorne during that. And the witch curses him. Oh, no, I forget what it is. They don't have a baby yet. He's just trying to please his wife, the man. And that's why he goes over there, essentially the king. And he grabs this Rapunzi flower. The witch takes him away and says that, you know, if you want to get out of this, you basically have to give up your firstborn daughter to me, essentially.
Gotcha, right.
And that's kind of the essence of that. And then, of course, he has to give it up. Rapunzel is born. And then the witch takes her up, puts her in that tower. She's got to lound down her hair. The man has to climb up. The lover has to climb up her hair. He gets like his eyes stabbed out. And then eventually they come together and, you know, it's all fixed. I'm blanking on some of the important details, of course. But the fairy tales are really good because they're these broad, you know, structure stories. And, you know, that you could, it's really important to think about the roles of each of these characters, right? So the male is blinded in his attempt to find and sleep with the lover who's been protected by the old witch or the mother figure, right?
Yeah.
And the witch is a witch, by the way, because she can't have kids. So it's a fertility story.
Yeah.
And now in Rappaccini's, though, in Hawthorne, he has, in a sense, flipped the role and make it, instead of a witch, it's an old man. It's an old doctor, or in this case, Dr. Rappaccini. And it's his daughter. That's why it's Rappaccini's daughter. It's about the male in a sense and his desire. So he doesn't put him up in a tower. He puts him at the bottom in a garden that he built for that, for her. And the garden is a corrupt Eden.
Mm.
So it's a corrupt Eden. So it's its own little Eden, but it's poisonous. So when you talk about, you know, if you think about symbols, that's part of it. Is Eden is this perfect land of where man went before God, right? And it's where food fell from the sky. You're taken care of, but everything is good. But, you know, there's obviously the flaw of, or the problem of the guard, you know, eating
the snake,
the snake, and eating from the tree of good and, of the knowledge of good and evil.
Right.
So in this case, we don't have quite that, but we have this corrupt or this evil shrub. And what that does is it actually infects the people who come into its vicinity, like Giovanni Guasconti.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like, I think, and there's a lot, I mean, there's so many layers you could take in different perspectives that you could take.
Well, I'm kind of
story.
Like with writing, you know, it's a lot of it you can, you know, with any sort of story that has enough to it, it's almost like, well, how much is there that's symbolic here? How much is just this meant to be a good story? You know, because so many things are related just in terms of man's history and the cultural,
The question, so since this is a writing course, we can bring it back to that. For me, the question as a, from a writing perspective is how much control do you have over that? So Hawthorne was very knowledgeable about fairy tales.
Okay.
He was very knowledgeable. For instance, here's the beginning of Rappaccini's Daughter. I'm not going to read the whole thing, just a little.
Yeah.
Real quick. The young stranger, this is the first paragraph, a couple of sentences down. The young stranger who was not unstudied in the great poem of his country, that's Italy. What's the great poem of Italy? And that's Dante, Inferno. Recollected that one of the ancestors of the family and perhaps an occupant of this very mansion, Reed Castle, had been pictured by Dante as a partaker of the immortal agonies of his Inferno. These reminiscences and associations, together with the tendency to heartbreak, natural to young men. So, you know, go on and so on and so forth. But the idea, though, is that he is now Dante, or excuse me, Giovanni has been situated in the story of Dante's Inferno.
Okay.
And even if you haven't read it,
goes to the character goes to the Hoth, underworld, right?
And he's led. Excuse me.
Cheers.
He's read or led when he goes into Paradiso. He's led by a woman. So in Inferno, he's led by, oh my gosh, Homer. When the Dante, because the story of Dante's Inferno is that Dante himself goes into the Inferno, then into Purgatorio, and then he's led through this, you know, he sees these people like Achilles and Odysseus and Virgil, things like that.
Okay.
And I believe it's Homer, and I'm forgetting, but who it may not be Homer actually. But anyway, he's led through it. But for sure, when he gets to paradise, Dante, he's led by a woman named Beatrice.
Okay.
And so that's part of the connection. Now, even if you don't know that, that's okay. Rappaccini's daughter has its own internal structure. It has all the information. You could still enjoy it.
Yeah.
But the point is from a writer's perspective, and this is why it's so important to read a lot.
Yeah,
like it's your job. It's like if you were a doctor, but you didn't read about the anatomy of it's stupid.
Yeah.
Or didn't understand how blood streams work. If you're a fiction writer, you should be an expert literary person who understands all that came before you.
Yeah.
In the genre that you're in, the field that you're writing in. Otherwise, you're a hack.
Or as much
literally
as
a hack. Like you're just hacking all of what's that?
Or as much as you're capable of, you know, integrating into your,
because
there's so much at this point that to read that you would,
well,
you know, it would take a lot to read.
You can't read everything for sure,
you know,
but you can definitely read. There's you can read the vast majority in your field, and that I think is like why you have like even in today's world. George R. R. Martin is one of the most successful writers of our time, right? Mm-hmm. Fiction writers.
Yeah.
He is an expert in the fantasy world. He could give lectures on fantasy.
Yeah.
I mean, he named himself George R. R. Martin after J.R.R. Tolkien.
Pretty, yeah. Right?
He literally did that. He knows about fantasies of all kinds. He reads all kinds of fantasies. He also is a history expert, right? So the point is that from a writing course, if you're trying to write either in a genre or just anything, it's so important to become really knowledgeable, not just in a cursory glance like, oh yeah, you know, I once maybe did something with Rappaccini, but, you know, really taking key texts and studying them. Like Rappaccini's daughter in my
opinion.
So.
Yeah, this is, like I was saying about short stories too, it gives you like a glimpse and a feel for different authors if you're more on a time crunch. You know, at least, you know, I've read Hawthorne now because I've read this and I've read Wakefield. I have a feel for what Hawthorne is, you know, but there's more that could be discovered there. But yeah, so, okay, so without going into the spoiler, because that's where we were getting with some of the symbolism, if you want, or the interpretation there deals with the end, the plot device at the end of the remedy. So we have an overview of these. We have an overview of these, and we have an overview of the authors. And so we can move into now, I guess, either dealing with the endings of these and what the meaning is based on the endings, like sense of life, or just in terms of plot. What do you think?
I think at this point we should just actually leave that to the course.
Okay.
If people are interested, or read the short stories.
Yeah.
If you're just listening to this just to learn about these three stories a little bit, I think that was a good discussion. My favorite is probably clear to you. The Rappaccini's Daughter is definitely my favorite. I think it has but it's also the longest. So it's a lot longer than the other ones. You know, and so it's the one, if you're going to take the course, we actually require you read it before start of the first class, because they're just, you know, just so you have enough time to read it. It's not a novel. I mean, it's like 20 pages, I think, or so, something like that. So it's not like some of the other ones, which are like basically the equivalent of 6 pages, maybe. So
you can lay down in an hour or whatever and read it.
Oh yeah.
No, reader, or maybe two nights if you're slower. I'm a slower with stuff like this. A little history of this. I started this for one of my courses because we have some choice in our from these anthologies of what we're going to analyze. And I started this, and it was slower reading for me at that time. So I actually didn't read this for a few months and came back to it. Kirk was talking about Hawthorne. And then as I read a few pages, I got more into the style of it and read a little more quickly. But it's kind of like Hugo, like it's slower reading, but you feel more, for me, I feel more accomplished at the end of it, you know.
Well,
more vocabulary.
It's something to learn. It's one of, exactly. It's one of the things to learn as a writer. And this is why I say you need to be well read in breadth and depth. Mm-hmm. So you should choose what you want to be depth if you want to be a good writer, in my opinion. You know, so if you want to write modern sci-fi stuff, that's great. You should be really well read in the, golden age of sci-fi and on. This is, you know, Heinlein, Asimov, and the other guys. I'm blanking on a whole bunch of names right now, but there's a whole bunch. There's a whole bunch of,
You got, I could just read you the list from this anthology. Yeah, like basically all the big guys.
Like H.G. Wells, Gernbach.
H.G. Wells.
Yeah. Joseph, Ballard, John Campbell. That's what I was thinking of. Butler, John Campbell.
Jules Verne, Edmund Hamilton.
Yeah. Clark and Bradbury.
Like Frank Herbert.
Frank Herbert, who I'm reading for the first time. Actually, I just started Dune. I've never read it. So I'm reading Dune finally.
I've heard of that. Yeah.
You've heard of that? What do you mean you've heard? It's like one of the biggest.
I've heard of Dune. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot, man.
There's a lot.
But you're a lot of time just playing guitar too. You know, like.
All right, fair enough.
Philip K. Dick. There's a lot too, and then some of it.
I do like Philip K. Dick, but so the point I was trying to make is like choose, you know, as like writing advice for fiction, choose what you want to get depth in. So if you want to do sci-fi, but you know you can't read everything sci-fi ever, so choose like. You're going to read all of Arthur C. Clarke and Heinlein and some Asimov, and you're going to become kind of an expert in that field and really go deep into that. And then breadth, I would say you should also read a little bit of Dostoevsky, you know, even if it's Notes from an Underground, read a romantic 19th century novel once in a while in short story, like get a little taste from around the world, read Ivan, right? Read there's, a whole bunch of stories you could read, just pick up some, read Maul Flanders, pick up some Spanish novels and just kind of get an idea. Quo Vadis or Don Quixote, I should say. And Quo Vadis would be another, get some breadth and then choose a depth, right? That I think is one of the important things. And this course is just a tiny little taste to get you started or, you know, even if you're already doing it, add a little bit to that. That's the,
you know, we're both into lifting weights, and that it's interesting because it mirrors a lot of the best strength and conditioning thought, which is you want a big solid base of physical preparedness to draw on, and then you want to specialize. You want a big solid base of all sorts of movements and modalities, and then you want to specialize in that.
Yeah,
and then go deep into that. But you want a big people with a larger base, and the shows is with child sports too. And I think it probably would reflect that in learning. Those with a big base early on that then specialize have a longer and more productive career in what they're doing. And there are exceptions to the rule, but I found that's true in learning in general.
Are there? I'd be curious if there were.
There are exceptions, like not with, like, there's a few exceptions, like, in terms of sports, like gymnastics and things, but as far as, like, the field sports go and stuff like that, there's people
where they don't have a strong base?
Where, like, the people with the broader base, like, that played, like, all three or four sports and things like that were...
No, but I mean, like, that's... okay, so to refine that...
I don't want to get off topic, but...
No, because I think it's important. So, like, a gymnast still needs to have strong legs, core, arms, you know, especially strong legs... That's kind of their base, but then they specialize in a certain form of movement. And so, but you can't just specialize in a form of movement and have weak legs. You're going to collapse.
Yeah.
And so you need the strong base.
Talk about another study they did. They did a study on medical students, and they found, had to do with like memorization and I think understanding of the materials that they were integrating.
Uh-huh.
And they found that the students who took art history did better on the memorization for medical, like MCAT studies, than those who didn't. That just did more studying. So Yeah. This, you know, I guess there's a book by, I think it's David Epstein, called The Range, Range, that I've listened to some of the podcasts. But okay. It's kind of an opposition to the 10,000 hours thing. So, you know, I get kind of, have you heard of the 10,000 hour
rule? Oh, you do, I know.
10,000 hours. Oh, yeah. So we're just getting into, you know, cultural, you know, pop science. But, I was thinking about this yesterday with writing. It's like, I think Ayn Rand's recommendation to program your subconscious, like, as me as a writer, you know, try to keep focus on, the simple things, plot, theme, characterization.
Yeah, but style. How do you program your subconscious?
And then you program your subconscious by reading works that if that means like as a science fiction writer, listening to a song, like say you're Rush, I hate that to use that cliche example or something, but if Rush is going to program your subconscious better than reading George R. R. Martin, and you're a science fiction short story writer, then I would say go with the listening to Rush.
Well, I don't think there's any way to do that.
I think it's more important as an artist to have that kind of like fire or whatever. But anyway, yeah, you're right.
I don't agree with that. Sorry. I think that particular, first of all, I don't see why you can't do both.
There's no reason. Time is always a thing, you know?
Well, but I mean, this is my point though. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to do, here's the question. Do you want to write sci-fi or write anything because it's a fun hobby, or is this your career? Because if it's your career, that's not how you look at it. That it's just time. It's like, oh, well, you know, I want to be a doctor, but time. Like, yeah, you got to get all your time to studying doctor, right?
Even a person studying to be a doctor has to make decisions like that based on like,
but
how
you still have to have the amount of knowledge. It doesn't matter how you get that structure of knowledge.
What amount of knowledge, like,
This is my point, though. Okay. That's the point. Like,
that's a question for somebody who's like a literary. How extensively did Ram study philosophy? Did she read all of Kant's works?
She majored in philosophy. Her teacher was one of the most renowned Plato scholars. She studied intensely her whole life philosophy, all the way up until she was dead. She studied. She read all the time. She read Aristotle, she read Plato, she read Kant, she read Nietzsche when she was like a teenager, very young.
Yeah, but did she just like read through like Peter Singer? I mean, he wasn't around then, or, you know.
No, she read Aristotle.
You have to make decisions.
No, she read Aristotle. She was extraordinary.
Well, of course, reading Aristotle, yeah, because Aristotle is the good
Heidegger. She read Hegel. She read Nietzsche. Okay, she was a philosopher. She had things to say about all of them. This is,
but I mean, I don't see how, you know, I mean, a person can only read so much. I mean, really read every, you know, the whole corpus of philosophy.
We're really disagreeing on this.
Fiction, you know?
Yes.
Really?
Oh yeah.
I mean,
that's your job. No,
know,
you can't read everything.
Yes. I don't know. I don't see how. Maybe we'd have to do the math on how many hours that would take. But I mean, I can't.
No,
yeah.
You can't.
It's
read,
a marginal issue anyway.
You can't. It's not a marginal issue. This is the essence. You can't. This is where I do agree. You cannot read everything ever written, obviously. Yeah. But there is a corpus that's already been established of like the most important things. And maybe you could say like in science fiction. So starting with really, if I were recommending to someone, and this is something I'm currently doing, is I would start with gothic fiction, at least find a couple, 18th century into 1800s, really just find like Castle of Otranto, which I've read, and The Monk by Matthew Lewis. Those are the important ones. And there are courses you can take that say, here are 40 books and stories to read. That'll give you a really good understanding. And these are the core books. Take that and read all of them though. And that's a thing that you do. That's education. That's like, it's like saying, okay, to become a surgeon, you need to read these books. You need to have these things studied and mastered so that it's so second nature. And then you need to practice this many times. Yeah. That's it. And that's what I'm saying is it's the same thing with literature. If you want to write.
Oh, for sure.
If you want to write.
It's going to help
literature.
You. I mean, there's probably a prodigy out there, that could, you know, do a lot, which is watching movies and then just really good grammar and a dictionary. But, you know, not the approach you'd want to recommend to a student.
I would be willing to bet that person could not write literary fiction. What they could do is write TV shows and screenplays, which is why all the great writers we have write TV. Like, all the great writing today is not in the literature field much. It's in TVs and movies, because the smart, good writers are going there, because that's, and I don't blame them. That's where the money is. And you can, I think, watch a lot of TV, and I think you need to read a lot of scripts. Most, if you listen to interviews of these guys, they read hundreds of scripts. Like, it's part of the first journey that they take in writing. Yeah. And then they write. Right. And then
they always told me in my when I was theater arts minor or whatever, they tell me, you know, Shakespeare's Live, they'd be writing for HBO. But yeah, it is an art. There's a certain level of there's a huge element of talent in art that's innate. And things can be learned, but I will tell this to my students. Some people are better at stuff than other people in sports, in learning, and in art. And that's just how it is.
Yeah.
The quicker you get your head around that, the quicker you'll be able to start working on with the tools that you have.
So, but those are the things you don't have control over.
Yeah.
What you do have control over is training your subconscious.
Yeah.
Whatever subconscious you may have, maybe you have a slightly weaker subconscious than someone else. I think I have a very weak subconscious. I actually think my intelligence is quite low, but I've trained it by reading a lot as intensely as possible to the best of my ability. But that takes reading a lot. And if you want to be in writing and getting all of that out there, that's the training of it. And whether you're a genius like Ayn Rand, in my opinion, I think, or Dostoevsky or whoever, or you're just, you know, they were well-read. Like, I will challenge you to find someone who was a very successful author and wrote that things that lasted the test of time and was not super well-read.
Yeah. I mean,
not going to find
it. Yeah. Did you think about, like, somebody like Ayn Rand says, like, she woke up at every day and sat at her desk writing till from 6 to 5. Well, was she reading other things while she did that? Or she apparently she just sat there. And
if you want to talk about her schedule, we could do that at some point. Yeah. She read at night. She didn't watch as much TV as we do. Yeah. And she didn't have kids. And I don't think that her pen was on her paper for 8 hours. No author does that. She would walk around. She would read some, but she had it in her mind where this was work time from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. and she wouldn't have any schedules, but you know, she would have time for reading. She would have time for, you know, writing out things, taking notes, stuff like that.
Yeah. And we're getting on a tangent of just people's ability and historical, you know, but we're talking about, I think that with writing and reading, you're going to have to do a lot of reading if you want to write, even if you're reading your own thing and editing it over and over. It's like, we're talking a lot of time spent with words and with stories.
True.
However that shakes out for different people, I think you're going to find a lot of greats that have went about it different ways. Somebody like Stephen King, who started writing early really well and has written enormous amount of work, you know. Somebody like that might be spending more time.
He reads a lot.
I'm sure.
He reads a lot.
I mean, this is
that's
like,
all he does is read.
I know. Well, yeah.
That's my point. It's like, if you want to be a full-time career fiction writer, you got to read like a full-time fiction writer, period.
Oh, yeah.
That's all there is to it.
For sure.
And you could start with this course.
I have no plans to be I just do this, you know, academically. I learned, you know, a few years ago that I'm not the guy that can just sit there and write all day long or even read all day long. Like, I got to get up and do some things that are not literature.
Yeah, no, I think that's true.
The cool thing about literature is, while I'm driving in my car or I'm cleaning out a rental, I can think about stories and stuff. So it's more like that. It's been like conducive to having a varied lifestyle more than music, where it's harder for me to like just come up with a melody or a rhyme or to like work on my scales on guitar while I'm, you know, mowing the lawn. But with stories and stuff, you can totally sit there and digest Hawthorne while you're cutting weeds, you know?
Yeah.
Because you have the story in your mind. Thinking about it.
100% agree. And you have to, my whole point is, you have to push yourself to read more. That's if you want to be writing more. Like, so don't let yourself off the hook. You know, some people, like you said, are going to be able to read more and better, and they have more of an ability to focus for longer than you do. And that's fine. And they're going to be able to probably write things like, you know, Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, which is an intense book to read, that he was able to write that, you know, like, it's like just thinking about all that was included in that book, or, you know, Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged or something, like, or Proust, for God's sakes, which I've never read. I've only read certain sections, but you think about it as like multi-thousand page stories, these super complex. And it's like, yeah, that's a certain different beast than what I'm ever going to accomplish. And so I agree with what you're saying in that.
Yeah. It's interesting. You see this on the amateur or academic level within the schools and the MFA setting, because you're reading you have 12 classmates in a class, and you're reading their analyses of fiction. So you're getting a feel for how they analyze stuff, how astute they are at it. And then you also read their workshop pieces, the things that they've written. And there's a variety. Like, some students are really good at analyzing things, but they're not imaginative. They're just dull writers, you know? It's just like, this isn't that good. And then you have some people with horrible grammar. I remember one student, his grammar was horrible, even in his fiction piece, but it was way more imaginative and just like cool than anybody else, you know? And I was like, wow, there's two different things going on here that are related, but that, you know, but it also could be that these people are just at different stages in their development too. But yeah, I mean, try to find a person who wants to write that doesn't love reading. I mean, come on, that's like,
yeah. You know, well, but their grammar, but I think some people do fall in love with the idea of writing.
They don't actually want to do the work. That's what my course is for. Those people, they can get a feel to see if, am I actually interested?
Like, there you go. I think it's a good taste. It's only $20. You know, it's fun. You can come in, you could write and get feedback, and I'll give feedback and be there as well. And then, you know, so you'll get Joe and you'll get me both. And, you know, I won't be, like I said, lecturing or anything, but it'll be but I will look at your work. Right. And we'll see about maybe even publishing something or working on editing it for publication if you're interested for Troubadour. So that's kind of the only value I can say from our perspective.
If you're a medical student, it might help you memorize things for your MCAT.
You're going out on a
tangent there, you know? It's fun. It's
good. And vice versa, by the way, like, if you're a literary person, your mind will be improved and sharpened, and you get more clarity and precision if you study math, right? And engineering and sciences. Like, that will hone your mind and make it more precise and clear. So it's both. Yeah. And, you know, when you talk about like this issue with Grant, like this guy who's not grammar, so versus he's very imaginative. The sad part about that is that grammar is not something you're good at, like, from birth or something like that. That's not like innate in any way. That's a skill you learn. They used to call what we call like first through fifth or sixth grade, that used to be called grammar school, because you should have been an expert in grammar school or grammar by that point, because that's our basic speech and language. But our public school system, which you and I have gone through, I went through it in California, is abysmal. It's the worst.
They tied the Dewey thing. Is that part of that cause?
That's part of like the look-see method is what they teach. In terms of teaching a read. John Dewey was a big impact in the education system.
I was always advanced in my reading and then a little bit behind in my writing. And then in high school years, I was a really good science student. I was in AP English and stuff, but I could read anything, but my writing, I didn't care about it. I wrote poetry. I was into songs and good stories, but my writing was just like abysmal, you know, kind of thing like this. Yeah.
Well, so this
kid, what I'm trying to say, you know.
Yeah, yeah, the problem is, you know, with one good grammar course, he could rectify that, and his imagination will make sense.
Yeah.
And we could do another show eventually about like innate talent and imagination, and you know, but I think a lot of that is trainable. So I believe that a writer, that anybody who speaks English can write decent to good literary fiction through work, not innate talent. Now, I do think there is a level of how difficult it's going to be and to what level you can attain based on your innate abilities, just like in sports.
Yeah.
But I do think that anybody, can train to do that.
Yeah. I've taught guitar. It's not like guitar where if you don't, You know, with guitar, I tell people, if you pick up the guitar and actually play it and develop the calluses for one on your fingers, then you start to get some dexterity, then you're going to have to go through that period. But the good thing about writing, if you can clarify your thinking and if you can learn to think in terms of, you know, plot, obstacles, character motivation, concretizing the abstraction that you're trying to present, those things can be, you know, but whether or not that process is going to be enjoyable for you, whether or not you have the kind of mind that's just sitting there thinking of that,
and reading,
that's a whole different thing. So
that's right. And you could, guys, we're going to end here. You could start with taking this sci-fi lit and writing course. Check it out. Give us feedback. Take the course. Have some fun with it. We're only accepting 10 people. So get signed up. You know, even if you're not a writer, sign up. Read some sci-fi. Jot down your notes. And we're going to help you with the scaffolding to write an essay if you don't want to write fiction. That's fine, too. So thank you guys for listening. Thank you, Joe. This has been fun. You know, even if you don't take the course, I understand. I was only kidding about you having to take it. Read these three short stories. You'll enjoy them.
All right. Thank you, guys. See you there.